1 year and 10 days after water started to flood across the surface of the world, Noah and his family peered out from the ark's open door onto a world remade. In the bright glare of the sunlight, unfiltered any longer by the watery vapor that had enveloped the world since creation, Noah contemplated vistas never before seen. The sky, for one, was dotted by clouds, and there was a distinct dryness and bite to the air at the elevation where the ark had come to rest. Already, two of the ark's occupants, a raven and a dove, had left the confines of the great vessel for new roosts in the vast wilderness that the world had become. The day had come for all the other creatures in the ark to do the same. How the routines had changed in the final days on board the ark, we can't imagine, particularly in this period of which we read, from Noah's birthday, the first day of the first month of the 601st year of his life, from that day until the 27th day of the second month, nearly a two-month period there from verse 13 to verse 14, how the routines had changed, we really can't imagine. There had to continue, of course, to be the feedings of the animals and the cleanings after the animals. But the general anticipation of something different must surely have been in the ark. The day finally came when the gates to the various enclosures on the three decks were opened, and the animals were let out. I wonder if there were any offspring that had been born in the year they had spent on board. Possibly that would have been so. The Bible is silent about that point. And yet, as they had entered the ark, the animals left it. Males and females. I think I should emphasize that. We do not read of males and males or females and females. They came male and female. They left male and female. Perhaps they left a little tentatively at first. But then, undoubtedly, with greater abandon. Dinosaurs and great mastodons and woolly mammoths lumbered down the ark's entry ramp onto the mountainside below. Great cats joined in the unlikely parade. Various winged creatures flew out of the ark and soared into the sky that was much bluer than it had ever been before. Reptiles of all kinds slithered their way down to the ground and glided away into changed surroundings. Noah and his wife and his sons and their wives made their way through the ark's great doorway and onto the surface of the world. What were their thoughts as they stood together there, gazing on the mountain ridges that stretched before them? In all the world, they were the only people. Never again could anyone in the world doubt the promise of God. Everything that God had proclaimed had come to pass. The long year on the ark, a year and a few days, had come to its end. But for the people who had survived the great flood, there must have been a certain sense of remoteness when they considered the world they had left behind just over a year before. They could remember it vividly, and especially the faces of the people they had seen in the days before the judgment of God fell. But it must have seemed to Noah and his family that it was a very long time before. From that point on, whatever would become of the human race in the world, Noah and his family knew that they were looking at the progenitors of that race. Furthermore, they understood that they would have to bear the message of what had happened to all of those who would come after them. There was no written word of God. But the people who stood below the entrance to the ark could not mistake the reality of God's existence or of their complete dependence upon Him. Nor could they get away from the reality of the gospel message. They knew that they were sinners, and that the only reason that they were standing in a world made over again was that God had been gracious to them. This evening, let us stand together with them, as it were, and let us ponder the amazing reality they confronted in entering the new world. October the 12th, 1492, used to be a date that every child knew from early times in school. I don't know anymore whether that's so or not, but it was on that date that Christopher Columbus, an Italian from Genoa but sailing for Spain, set foot on the shore of an island in the chain now called the Bahamas. Now, Columbus thought that he had reached his goal of a western passage to the East Indies. That was why he had set out. That was the commission he had from Ferdinand and Isabella. But subsequent voyages that he made and that others made convinced everyone that there was no such passage, and that he had discovered what to the Europeans came to be called the New World. Now, it was anything but new, especially to the people who were already living there. I don't think they regarded this as a great discovery. They had already been living there. To them it was not new. But the fascination with that which the Europeans regarded as new made the succeeding age of exploration a time for wonders. Well, the world that Noah and his family encountered was new. No one had ever walked in it before. The animals that had lived with them in the ark soon dispersed. They followed their instincts, by the way. They weren't being directed in any way by Noah and his family as to what they should do. They followed their instincts to go and build their own homes and to reproduce themselves. Initially, Noah and his family probably stayed near the shelter of the ark. There were no doubt supplies that they had with them in the ark upon which they depended. But eventually, they would make their way down the slopes of the mountain to the warmer valleys below, for it was cold up on the top. There below they began to build a new life. Now much of the technological accomplishments of the old world had been buried with it in the flood. I don't think we can minimize those accomplishments. But the truth was, life in the new world would prove to be much harsher than Noah and his family had known in the old world. And the needs that they would find would be much different. At the end of chapter 8, we read that seasons would appear. Summer and winter. Spring and fall. Seed time and harvest. Snow would fall. Something that had never happened before. The earth's crust would continue to groan and shake. Huge plumes of ash would shoot up from volcanoes into the atmosphere and darken the sky. Soon, it would be necessary for people to adopt different methods of providing shelter. Some would become cave dwellers, recording their lives in elaborate drawings on the walls of the caves where they lived. And those drawings can be seen to this day in some places in the world. Those in harsher climates would fashion elaborate clothing out of the skins of animals, almost becoming the appearance of animals themselves. Those who lived along waterways would learn how to cut down trees and fashion them into boats. The human race was starting over. But in the new world, the human race lacked one important ingredient. It lacked the intelligence that had marked Adam and his immediate descendants. The technological know-how that had made that civilization in the world before the flood a truly amazing thing. Living in the new world would be a far greater challenge. Even more so when new disorders began to appear in human bodies. And people began to die much more rapidly than had been the case before. As we come to consider what it was for Noah and his family to enter this new world, there are three aspects of this passage that come before us. I want you to look at them. First, the new environment. We read in verse 13 that on his birthday, Noah removed the covering of the ark. Now, we are told that when the ark was to be built, Noah was instructed to put a door in the ark. And it was through that door that all the animals and Noah and his family gained access to the inside of the ark. They went in, and we read that the Lord shut them in. How the Lord did that, we're not told. But we learn in this verse that there was a covering on the ark, something that sealed the doorway. Now the day came for Noah to remove that covering and to open the door again into the ark. Only this time it was so they could look out. Now, when he opened that door and looked at the ground, he could see, as we read in verse 13, that the face of the ground was dry. Now, at this time, evidently, the ground itself, below the surface, was still very wet, because it was nearly 2 months before Noah and his family received the commandment to leave the ark. So we can conclude that the footing was still not good. But he saw that the face of the ground was dry. There was no more water remaining on the face of the ground. Now, Noah had no way of gauging their altitude, and that was probably a concept he didn't even understand. But they were much higher above sea level where they were than anyone had ever been in the world before the flood. Mountains had been pushed up to heights that the people in the world before the flood could never have imagined possible. Under the surface of the ground, especially down in the valleys below, there was buried beneath tons and tons of sediment. Sediment that was already hardening into rock. Every last vestige of the world they had known, it was gone. All of the vegetation, all of the animals, all of the people, everything buried. Bodies of people by the hundreds of millions were encased beneath the earth's surface in various states of decomposition. The burial grounds of Adam and his descendants had been obliterated. No one could tell anymore where they were. All of the machinery that had been invented, and I'm sure there was a lot of it, and that had made the civilization of that world such a wonder, was gone as well. So that whatever Noah and his family carried with them into the ark was all that was left of the world that was gone. That was all they had with which to begin life anew in a world that was new. And as they pondered that reality, and that was, I think, a sobering reality, that not only were they alone in the world, but in terms of the papers and all that they needed to support themselves in the world, they were all in the ark. There was nothing else left. But as they pondered that reality, they had to face other realities, ongoing adjustments in this new world. We read earlier in considering the flood that the fountains of the great deep had been broken up. That is, these vast subterranean reservoirs of water that apparently were held in under some pressure. When those fountains were ruptured or broken up, that water shot up into the air and fell across the ground. Those ruptures had been so violent, and the powerful tidal forces of the global ocean had been so strong that the surface of the earth had been shaped in a different way. There were going to be canyons formed as the floodwaters drained away. The Grand Canyon was formed in that way. There were going to be mountains pushed up by the pressure of the water down below. Great trenches were going to be opened in the oceans. Undoubtedly, tidal waves rolled across the surface of that ocean. When the water drained away, Noah and his family emerged from the ark into a period of intense seismic activity, volcanic eruptions. When we were in Flagstaff just a week ago, we visited Sunset Crater, which is a cinder cone volcano, a volcano formed from the eruption along a 9-mile vent of ash and flame, and formed this cinder cone. That vent in the earth's surface was a legacy of the flood, as is all volcanic activity. And you can look in the visitor center there at a display that shows earthquake activity around the world, and you can see it almost up to the minute. the severity of the quakes, the location, and how long ago they have occurred. And you can see literally a line, a ring, if you will, of fire, as they call it, around the Pacific Rim. All of that is the result of the flood. The earthquakes that to this day rip across Turkey, the area where the ark came to rest, those are legacies of the flood. And before very long, the climate of the world began to change as well, and dramatically. Now, before the flood, we have talked about the vapor canopy that surrounded the world. And that vapor canopy had moderated the temperatures around the world so that the world was a very temperate place, even at the poles. And to this day, there are being found fossils at the poles of plants that at one time lived in those areas. After the flood, though, surface temperatures, especially at the poles, began to drop. There was no more vapor canopy. And so the heat that was in the oceans began to radiate out into the atmosphere. And as it did so, it formed, of course, clouds and systems of wind. And with all of that abundant moisture and the cold polar winds, it was not very long until snow began to fall. And the water at the poles, especially in areas where it wasn't so turbulent, began to freeze. And the freezing continued for a very long time. Then as the water would freeze and the snow would fall upon it, of course the ice began to accumulate. And pretty soon huge sheets of ice began to spread from the poles, from the North Pole down to the South, from the South Pole up to the North. And they spread very far, where if you would look on a map today, the ice sheets spread all the way down into the middle of the North American continent. And you can see evidence to this day in many places in the northern part of this country of those ice sheets that formed in what is called the Ice Age. Now, as the temperatures continued to fall in those areas, more and more of the world's water was being sucked up and turned into ice and snow. Now, there's a phenomenon I think we need to keep in mind, and that is the amount of water that was in the world after the flood is the same amount of water that is in the world today. Can I say that again? It hasn't evaporated off into space. I mean, to hear some people talk, you would think we have an awful water problem. There's just not enough water. If we don't conserve the water, there just won't be any more. The water is not going away. The same amount of water is here now. But in that period after the flood, more and more of it was being stored on the surface of the earth in ice. Now, as that happened, the level of the oceans began to fall. You can imagine, more and more of the water is in ice, there's less and less of the water in the oceans. And some estimates are that ocean levels dropped as much as 400 feet below the levels that they are now. Now that is a lot, 400 feet. At such depths, much more land would be in view along the coastlines of the continents, and land bridges, such as that which would have connected North America to Asia, land bridges would have been exposed. And you can see the providence of God in that, because it enabled people to cross from Asia into North America. At the same time, The huge disparity in global temperatures spawned powerful tropical cyclones, known variously as hurricanes or typhoons. And just by the way, that they depend for their existence on a difference in temperature. To hear some people talk today, you would think that because everything's getting warmer and warmer, therefore the cyclones are going to become more powerful. But they depend on a difference in temperature. It's the Earth's way of regulating itself. And so we find that today, I just heard this the other day, we find that today the temperatures at the poles are actually going down. That the ice sheet in Antarctica is actually expanding, not shrinking. And because of that, the cyclones are stronger. Obviously, one of the pressing needs for people in the New World was going to be shelter. They needed protection from the weather. That was something that really was not such a pressing need in the Old World. They needed protection individually, they needed better clothing, and they needed protection collectively. So it was a far different place that Noah and his family encountered than they had known. And just as dramatically, generations afterward, the forces that had produced the global cooling after the flood reversed and led to global warming. How did that happen? There weren't any cars. There weren't any airplanes. My, to hear people talk today, you would think global warming has never happened before. Well, after the flood, plants began to reproduce themselves. There were more and more plants. Plants produce the byproducts of carbon dioxide. A plant takes in carbon dioxide and cycles carbon dioxide and produces byproducts that serve to raise the temperature of the atmosphere. And as more and more of these gases were put into the atmosphere, the temperatures began to rise. And what happened? The ice sheets began to melt back. And what happened then? The oceans began to rise. Now, it wasn't such an issue then because people had not built 40-story hotels right on the brink of the ocean. But the oceans began to rise. And pretty soon the climate worldwide tended to moderate so that the harshest elements of the climate were reserved for high elevations or the polar regions. And what happened then? Agriculture became more feasible farther and farther away from the Creator, from the equator. There are benefits to global warming, and that is that there are areas that can be farmed that could not be farmed before. So here was the reality that Noah and his family faced when they left the ark. In what then were they to rely as they did so? Well, we come to the second thing in this passage, and that is the divine directive. And here we find the words of verse 16, the words of God to Noah. Go forth of the ark, thou and thy wife and thy sons' wives with thee. Here was the command, leave the ark. Now, they had entered the ark at the direction of God. And when I read these words in verse 16, I believe that they were waiting for such a word to leave the ark. They would not venture out without such a word. And what a lesson that is for us. The constant that was going to be their mainstay in the new world was divine revelation. A lesson for us. It teaches us that at its most fundamental level, when they were leaving the ark, when the world was completely remade, when all they had left was whatever was in the ark with them, at its most fundamental level, they were going to move on the Word of God and not on anything else. And the other aspect of that is that God would not leave them without that Word. God did not bring them to this point where they opened the door of the ark and then leave them to make up their own mind and to go their own way. He now directed them, it's time to go out. I told you to go in. Now the reason for which I told you to go in has been accomplished. It's time for you to go out. Maybe they were frightened. Maybe they wondered, is something like that going to happen again? Maybe they better stick near the ark in case they would need its shelter again. But God was now telling them, leave the ark. And with the Word of God directing them, what could they know? They could know that all was going to be well. Whatever the challenges they would face, and they were going to face them, they would know that God had not abandoned them. That His gracious care that put them in the ark and saved them in the ark from the wrath that had destroyed the world, that gracious care would now sustain them in the new world into which they were entering. And they were going to need that revelation of God. For there was something else they took with them out of the ark. And that's the third thing I would have you to see. The undeniable legacy. God told them to go out, and so they did. But in the year and 10 days that they had spent in the ark, their natures had not been changed. They entered the ark as sinners. And that was how they left it. That was Adam's legacy to them. And that was their legacy to us. For all the grace that Noah and his family knew, and they knew great grace, they were still sinners. They were still descendants of Adam. They were still marked by total depravity. The New Testament speaks eloquently about this legacy. Let us turn to Paul's epistle to the Romans and to chapter 5. Romans chapter 5 and verse 12. Wherefore, as by one man sin entered into the world, and death by sin, and so death passed upon all men, for that all have sinned. Here was Adam's legacy to Noah and his family. They were sinners, and what did they know? They had not died in the flood, but they were still going to die. The spiritual death of which Paul is speaking there in Romans 5 and verse 12 was their legacy. And it would become evident very quickly that while they had seen the old world buried, they had brought the legacy of the old world with them. They were still sinners. There's a word for us tonight. We are their descendants, and we are sinners. We are marked by total depravity. We come by it ultimately through Noah, through one of his sons, Shem or Ham or Japheth, and through him to Noah, and through Noah all the way to Adam. That is part of the legacy from the flood. But there's another part of that legacy that they brought with them out of the ark. And that's a very positive part of it. The way of salvation. They knew it. They knew the gospel. When they came out of that ark, and as the animals dispersed into the new world around them, Noah and his family knew the gospel. And what was the gospel? The gospel was that there was only one way to approach God, and that was on the ground of a substitutionary sacrifice. Noah had been directed to take with him into the ark 7 of every clean animal in the world. Obviously, that was to ensure that there would be ample reproduction of those clean animals, but also the odd one among the 7 was to be for the purpose of sacrifice. So that already there was a distinction between unclean and clean. Now, in our next message in this series, we're going to come to the last verses of this chapter and deal with this act of worship that Noah set about to do on the slopes of Mount Ararat, within sight of the ark. Let us remember, though, the great constant from the old world was the message of the gospel. They knew they had to approach God on the ground of shed blood, on the ground of a substitutionary sacrifice. What a message. Here's a new world. Here's a world where the whole environment has changed. A world where no doubt they felt the ground shaking under their feet periodically. Where they felt snow. They felt cold. They felt wind. These things they had never known before. The world was totally changed. But there was one thing that wasn't changed, and that was the way of the gospel. It was the same before they went into the ark as it was while they were on the ark and as it was when they came out of the ark. There was one way in which to deal with sin. It wasn't the way Adam and Eve had first attempted on their own in the Garden of Eden. It was the way of the sacrifice. And it pointed to the sacrifice that the Redeemer was going to make when He would come into the world. And that is one of the reasons why the Lord Jesus had so much to say about Noah and the flood. Was to emphasize that truth. They knew the way of the gospel. The undeniable legacy. They were sinners. But we may thank God they knew the way in which to approach God. And so in the new world, they were dependent as they had been in the old, on the grace of God in the blood of the sacrifice. And that is where we are. We are dependent on the same truth. It was a new world thousands of years ago. There's some debate about the exact date when all of this happened. But it was a long time ago, well over 4,000 years since the flood. But though there are so many years have passed, the gospel message is still the same. Come to God through the merits of our Redeemer's sacrifice. That's the only way of salvation. It's the only way now. It was the only way then. Let us then follow in the steps of Noah and rest in the work of our sacrifice.